Welcome to SciSection. My name is Yemna Joffrey, and I'm the journalist for the SciSection radio show broadcasted on CFMU 93.3 FM radio station. So we are here today with Dr. Nelson. So thank you so much for taking the time to meet with me today.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
And for our listeners who may not know the amazing work you're doing, I'll actually give you a chance to introduce yourself.
Thanks, Yemna. So I'm a professor in the Department of Kinesiology here at McMaster University, and I'm also a Canada Research Chair, Tier 2, in Sensory Motor Neuroscience. I did my undergraduate degree here at McMaster in the Faculty of Science, and this was followed by my doctoral studies at the University of Toronto. Afterwards, I did a postdoctoral fellowship at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the McGovern Institute for Brain Research. And I subsequently did a second postdoc position at the Toronto Western Hospital in the Division of Neurology and Movement Disorders.
Thank you so much for that background. I see that you definitely have had a lot of research on, you know, the neural system and brain. So what made you interested in actually conducting this research in the first place?
I became interested in studying neuroplasticity during my postdoctoral position at the Toronto Western Hospital. It was there that I was working on a research study involving patients with focal hand dystonia. These individuals have unwanted muscle contractions, typically during tasks that are highly repetitive and practiced. And these contractions can lead to difficulties performing regular tasks, and often they alter the career trajectory of these individuals. For example, several participants in our study had musician's dystonia, whereby unwanted movements in the hands were observed during playing a musical instrument. I had the interesting opportunity to perform some brain mapping using functional magnetic resonance imaging in patients with focal hand dystonia. So while the participants were lying within the magnetic resonance scanner, I stimulated their fingers using a vibration device. Well, what does this typically look like in the brain? Well, in a control participant, the fingers are represented in an orderly fashion from the thumb to the fifth digit. But that was not the case in the patients with focal hand dystonia. It was very interesting because we noticed that the representation of finger digits were highly overlapping and sometimes disorganized or even reversed. So this was evidence that neuroplasticity had taken place in an unwanted direction, and we call this maladaptive plasticity. So it inspired me to want to seek out new opportunities to change the adult human brain to induce neuroplasticity. And specifically, I like using non-invasive approaches to studying neuroplasticity.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much for that answer. I know most people typically think of plasticity in like a positive sense of, you know, increasing your ability to adapt to your environment, but many people don't really take into account the maladaptive, like the adaptations or the plasticity. What is the purpose of currently conducting research to induce plasticity in your models?
Well, the overarching purpose of my research is to understand how neuroplasticity is induced in humans and to create non-invasive approaches to induce neuroplasticity to benefit humans. So in my lab, we use something called transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is brain stimulation, non-invasive, and it can induce neuroplasticity. So this approach involves delivering an electrical current through a coil. And the coil is shaped sort of like a figure of eight, and it induces a magnetic field that enters the brain and stimulates the neural tissue in the vicinity close to the location of this coil. So we use this approach to create short-term changes in the neural activity within the motor cortex, which is the area of your brain that participates in the control of your movement. So most recently, we showed that this approach could reduce symptoms of pain in an individual suffering from pain caused by spinal cord injury. We also use other non-invasive approaches to induce neuroplasticity, And one such approach involves using muscle activity called electromyography as biofeedback to improve motor control in certain patient populations. So in this example, we have different patients wearing electrodes on the arms and the legs, and they use their muscle contractions to control a video game interface. And they try to move objects on the screen in front of them using different combinations and patterns of their muscles. And what we're doing is we're teaching the brain new patterns of movement that have been lost, or they are new skills entirely for the individual. A third approach that we're using to induce neural plasticity involves both brain and muscle activity recorded simultaneously. So in this case, we use the EMG from the muscle, and we use something called electroencephalography from the brain. And what we do is we calculate the activity between them, the brain signal and the muscle signal. And this measure is called cortical muscular coherence. And we use this cortical muscular coherence as a source of feedback to participants to improve their performance in motor tasks. So for example, we have one study that investigates individuals with chronic neck pain, and the participant is required to rotate their head to a particular target location while brain signals and muscle signals from the neck are being recorded. The cortical muscular coherence is calculated for each trial and displayed to the participant, allowing them the opportunity to improve their cortical muscular coherence score in the next trial. So it's a feedback. And last, my lab uses physical exercise, like high-intensity aerobic exercise, as a means to induce neuroplasticity. And this seems to be a great option in patient populations capable of meeting the challenging demands of exercise. And we also see that exercise is a potent modulator of brain activity.
Thank you so much for letting us know about all these incredible techniques you're using in your lab, which I believe goes by the NeuroLab at McMaster.
That's correct.
Yeah, and it's incredible how many different integrated approaches that you have to, as you mentioned, strengthen muscles or strengthen muscle memory or induce new associations between the muscle and the mind, essentially. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, thank you so much for letting me know about that. And well, what are some key takeaways from what you have learned from your experiments, as you mentioned, at your NeuroLab at McMaster?
Yes, thanks for that question. I think that the takeaways are applicable to everyone doing research in neurosciences, particularly in non-invasive brain stimulation. One is that I really feel that research today should be interdisciplinary, involving expertise across a wide range of disciplines. And that's exactly what our lab does. So any research project in our lab can include faculty from engineering, science, and health sciences. We could even expand to humanities and social sciences. The important point here is that having the perspectives and expertise across widespread disciplines allows the science to be very rich and detailed and impactful. So I think that's a key takeaway from the work we do. In terms of brain stimulation, a key takeaway is that any brain stimulation study should be equipped with a placebo or sham control. We've noticed it's quite interesting how people respond to placebo stimulation and nothing is being induced into the brain at that time by the coil. So that's something we think about often. Another piece relates to the reliability of measurements. So we found in our brain stimulation approaches, we always need to include a measure of reliability. And this is because all our measurements, all our dependent measures, we call them, they can vary from one individual to another, and they can vary from day to day, even within an individual. So we need to incorporate statistical measures of reliability So we can understand better how our measures are fluctuating. That's what I would say are the main big takeaways. They're sort of big picture takeaways, but I think they're important.
I completely agree with you. They're incredibly important, especially the fact about creating results or finding results in lab that you can actually apply to a variety of real life situations and real life groups of people. So making it interdisciplinary rather than secluded to a specific field or a specific group of people. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I think the students gain so much more from that experience because they are exposed to multiple supervisors and they become leaders of a larger, more intensive project. So the experience overall is quite different for trainees when they're required to do an interdisciplinary project. It's difficult at first to create an interdisciplinary team. It takes a long time. It takes trust and you're developing professional relationships and friendships with people. It takes time, but at the end, I think that the results are worth the effort and time because we have a more thorough understanding of, for example, in our case, the mechanisms that underpin neuroplasticity.
Yeah, so the results are more meaningful. I completely agree with you, and I'm so glad that you brought that up, especially. And going back a little bit further into your past, Dr. Nelson, what do you think you did differently compared to your peers? So like when you were an undergraduate student that actually helped you become who you are today or develop the ideals about research and, as you mentioned, interdisciplinary research that you have today?
Well, if I go back to my undergraduate studies, it's a long time ago. So I don't think I knew anything of interdisciplinary studies at that time. I think that's emerged over the last maybe 6 years of my faculty position. But when I was an undergraduate student, I did have a chance to work closely with a professor in neuroscience here at McMaster. Her name was Dr. Judy Shedden. And I was very inspired by Judy. She introduced me to measurements of brain activity that we call EEG, and I spoke about them earlier. And I just loved working on my own research project and being a leader of a project. That was so exciting for me. It was really the first opportunity I had had in my undergrad degree to be able to have ownership over something that I cared so much about, if that makes any sense. And then I realized that Judy was, or I should call her Dr. Shedden at that time, I suppose, but now she's a colleague. I mean, she was doing something she loved so much, and she was getting paid for this. And it was sort of an eye-opener for myself that I could actually do something I love, have a lifelong, continuous journey of learning, and get paid for this. Well, what could be better than that? And so that's something that I really think I had a special opportunity and maybe some of my peers did not. And I think maybe some of my peers didn't because they didn't seek out those opportunities. It takes a bit of challenge, a bit of work, a bit of courage for sure to engage with professors, to have them open their door and have them give you a small chance. And Judy did that for me many years ago. And to this day, I still use EEG and occasionally meet Judy on campus.
That is such an incredible story that you're now working alongside the same mentor that you essentially had when you were an undergraduate student.
Very exciting. It's really nice to see, really.
So yeah, you did definitely already touch on this in terms of students who are listening to this show right now who may also be interested in pursuing research or a career in research. You mentioned especially like going out of your way to get that opportunity and persevering in terms of that initial research opportunity. But do you have any other advice that maybe you could give our listeners today?
I mean, I think getting in touch with a professor is sometimes a little difficult through email. And the problem probably that we all face is that we're inundated with emails from people interested in pursuing research. And there are so many highly qualified young people who want to be a part of your lab, and you only have space for a limited capacity. So I would encourage undergraduates to actually seek out the professors in person, to drop by their office and connect with them. I think that is a really sort of bold, courageous approach that seems to work very well for students, at least in my lab, where they've come to me and they discuss what they want to pursue. Maybe they don't have a research idea, but maybe it's just a genuine interest and desire to learn. Once we've met you, it makes it so much easier to converse with you over email and again in person, and improves the opportunity for you to have a placement in the lab. So I would really encourage students to directly connect with professors in person if you can. It can be as simple as waiting until after class and talking to your professor and saying, I really enjoyed your lecture. I want to know more about this. Is this the kind of work you do in your research lab? And then start like that, or drop by their office.
So in terms of what I've heard myself as an undergraduate student, I know many people still typically rely on these cold email approaches to try and get a placement. But I think you're completely right that it's important that you actually show your interest by physically being there and talking to the professor or other, you know, labs or whatever you're interested in, and being able to communicate with them like that. So yeah, in terms of maybe the scientific community as a whole, so instead of just like the undergraduate experience, what do you think the scientific community as a whole needs the most right now in terms of research or in terms of applying that research to populations? What are your thoughts on this?
Yes, I think that the most important drive right now is to take our basic science and translate it into applications for clinical populations. And that's where my lab is headed. We started this initiative about 4 or 5 years ago. Of course, we were delayed by the pandemic when our lab was closed, but we are back on this mission. We want to develop things that people actually need and want to use. So one of the new approaches we're using now is we're inviting patient populations into our lab early on in the development of research to find out and survey and garner what their interests really are. And then we're using that information to guide the development of the research so that the end product of what we're trying to achieve is something that can be applied directly to patient populations.
Yeah, so thank you so much for that answer, Dr. Nelson. It's really important, I think, to take it from a step-by-step basis and knowing if the population that you're trying to benefit actually do benefit from what you're researching or what tools you're actually trying to create. So yeah, that's a really important approach, I think. And for a final question, what do you think is the coolest or least well-known fact about neuroscience?
Well, I think people don't realize how big neuroscience is in our world. So the Society for Neuroscience is a society I belong to, and they have over 37,000 members worldwide. And we host one of the largest conferences in the world. And we're talking just days upon days and rows upon rows of posters, talks from trainees and professors. And it's very exciting. So the field of neuroscience is enormous, ranging from, you know, molecular neuroscience all the way through to computational neuroscience, behavioral and systems level neuroscience. so many different aspects of neuroscience that people can engage in. And the membership continues to grow. The areas and differentiation of these areas continue to flourish. So I think it's really an exciting field of research to be in.
I completely agree. I think neuroscience is so, I would say, or understated, even though it encompasses such an important part of our system, the brain and everything to do with the brain. So I hope our listeners today really get at least like a small taste of what it's like to conduct research within this field. And that's it for this week of SciSection. So make sure you check out our podcast available on global platforms for our latest interviews.